Whoa, I like your car, pal.
Hey, thanks, champ. You know what they say, you want to be the best, you got to drive the best.
Hey, not to get personal, but what's a sweet ride like that cost, anyways?
No, you know what? Actually, it's surprisingly affordable.
Yeah?
Yeah, if you saved every paycheck you earn for the rest of your life, then multiply it by 10, you could probably buy my muffler. Auga!
Oh, you want a drag race, do you? You win! Good job! Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm your host and curator, Devin Decker, and joining me, my host companion and co-curator on this journey into the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Sejin Serowik. Sejin?
Thank you, Devin. Yes, and tonight we're going to be talking about the family romp that is Bedtime Stories, the only Disney property that I have any knowledge of Sandler ever working on. Perhaps after we dissect this film a little bit more and talk about some of its less family-friendly aspects, why that may be.
Yes, and as a reminder, we are in season four, and this is a season for the fans. So this episode is on you guys.
This is all
That's what
your
I'm gonna
fault.
say. As much as I want to blame Sejin for demanding we make Bedtime Stories his birthday month movie, it's also on you. And you know what? I kind of appreciate it. I'm sitting here, I'm throwing shade at the fans for requesting Bedtime Stories, but I have to be honest with you, Sejin, and you actually alluded to it before we started recording. This is not a movie I think of when I think of Adam Sandler.
No, this is one of those ones that for me is exists in like there's a black hole, right? Where movies that you have heard about, you're well aware of, but they go because you just never think of them again, right? And that's actually most movies. Think about like on a regular basis, how often are you just recalling every film you've ever watched besides Devin? Like there is this idea that there is this idea, right, that there's a memory pit that you just chuck information into and you can't always pull stuff back out of it, right? That is this movie for me, tip to toe. Because in addition to the fact that every time I list Adam Sandler movies, I will never list Bedtime Stories. I just won't think of it. On top of that, I have now seen Bedtime Stories 3 times in my life, and tonight I am going to struggle to remember this movie as we talk about it. But I know I saw it. I know I saw it when it was in theaters. I know I've seen it once since then, sometime in intervening 15 years or something like that, 16 years.
14 years. This is
Yeah, something to
2008
that
film.
effect.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. But yeah, I know I've seen it somewhere in that decade and a half, right? But I also then watched it today for the show, and I am sitting here at this moment, scared, pantsless. We swear on this show. Why did I
Because
censor
we're
that?
being
Probably
family
because we're doing this
friendly, because it's a
because we're being
Disney
yeah.
property.
It's the PG Sandler movie, right? But like, I'm really worried I'm not going to be able to remember this movie by the time we're done recording. I feel
Good.
it slipping away from me, Devin.
If we talk about it, maybe we can remember. And if we remember, then it won't be forgotten. It's like that movie Coco, which is a better Disney-related property. But we're not talking about Coco, even though it would be appropriate here in October. We are talking about Bedtime Stories. I forgot the name of the movie. That's literally a thing I
Pretty
should
sure
have did.
you just called it Breadtime Stories, which is a much more interesting title to me too.
Bedtime Stories is the remake that's going to happen in about 5 more years, where it's Donald Duck telling the stories to Huey, Dewey, and Louie as Patrick and Bobby. I mean, that's what's going to happen, right? All of the animated Disney properties get live action remakes. All the live action ones are either going to get direct to Disney Plus sequels or animated reboots. And this movie would be great as Bedtime Stories, Donald Duck as Skeeter Bronson telling stories to HDL.
I thought we were going to go in a complete other direction. Disney gives up on the property and it gets picked up by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg to be the sequel to Sausage Fest.
That is another opera. You know what? There are two roads diverged in the yellow wood, and they will probably take neither and just let this movie die in a vine. And we'll get to why in just a little bit. But before we go any deeper on our journey into Bedtime Stories, let's tell the people why we're here, what the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast is all about. Basically, Seijin and I, circa the year 2020, watched a little film called Hubie Halloween, and along that film came an article talking about the shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films. And to me and to Seijin, that wasn't a surprise. That was something that both of us were aware of, and I occasionally celebrated. I don't want to talk about Seijin's rituals prior to that point. And that's what we said on the other podcast we do, the Say Report. And the response to us talking about Hubie Halloween and the existing cinematic universe of Adam Sandler from friends, relations, and listeners was overwhelmingly, if you two assholes think you know a thing about a shared Adam Sandler cinematic universe, then why don't you go out there and chart it?
this is such an in-depth view into the white male psyche of podcasting. Like, well, obviously people were clamoring for us to talk about it, so we had to record it. But yeah, no, we had a lot of people that kept talking to us about it, and we thought, you know, well, why don't we talk about it? And then we already record half of what we talk about with each other. Why not record the other?
Yeah. If not now, when? If not us, who? And now you're here at the ASCU with Devin and Seijin. And as also, I'm going to embellish a little bit here, right? Because it's what this movie is about. This movie is about telling stories, creating things, wish fulfillment, being grander than yourself. The most important thing to remember is we've been doing the ASCU now. This is our 25th episode. I don't think that's like monumental in podcasting. 25 episodes is like, good job. You were able to get together for 6 months. This one we do monthly, so don't look for another ASCU next week. Excuse me. But it's our 25th episode, and what we've been doing specifically in our fourth season, exploring the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, is a little bit of fan service. We're doing movies for the fans. These are the movies that people have asked us about, requested that we look into. And again, I mean, I was throwing shade and all of that, but I am happy. I'm happy that you reached out, that you let us know that you wanted us to cover a film like Bedtime Stories. And after watching it, hopefully I'm not blowing up my spot alongside this little reveal here and this thank you to our listeners. After watching it, I think I understand why, which has been my favorite part of the For the Fans season. I don't know if you share that with me, Seijin, but I step outside of myself when I watch these movies for the fans. I'm not just watching it for the show. I'm not just watching it for my personal entertainment. I'm trying to watch it and understand why somebody, when posed with, presented with a couple of jamokes who are going to go out and try to find some connective tissue behind the entire filmography of Adam Sandler, why I would want them to look at this certain movie. And I gotta tell you, I can understand why this movie would have connected with some people. But
I know as well, and I don't know if it's necessarily because I don't know of anybody that remembers this movie with the same fondness that they remember other movies of this ilk, right? Like, there's a lot of people out there that love The Game Plan. There's a lot of people out there that love The Pacifier, right? Like there is the Disney live action family comedy is a well beloved like market, right? This does not kind of rise to the top. There are some heavy hitters in that field, and this does not compete, right? And I think that despite that, there are definitely people that do remember this film fondly. I don't want to act like this movie does not have its fans. We'll talk about some facts and figures on it when we get to that portion later, but it doesn't do poorly, right? I'll reveal that much now. It survives. It's just not one of those ones that just like springs to mind, right? And I think the reason why people wanted us to talk about that is because I think all of the reasons why it doesn't spring to mind as an Adam Sandler movie is the Adam Sandler of it all in this movie.
I'm glad that you said that, because that's sort of my thesis going into this as well. We had a film release earlier this month, actually the end of last month, Hocus Pocus 2, and I know that Seijin is saving his viewing of that for his actual birthday. He's viewing it as a treat from Walt Disney himself, and I gotta tell you, Seijin, I do support you with that. You know, delayed gratification, all of that mumbo jumbo. But I'm so sorry. But watching Hocus Pocus 2, what I'm going to say is, it felt like it was genetically engineered to appeal to fans. And because of that genetic engineering, it didn't have any soul. And then watching the Walt Disney take on an Adam Sandler film, I got that same sort of vibe.
Yeah, so big reveal, and this is the handhold I promised you when we started talking tonight, when you were like, I don't know how we're going to do this. This is our, your literal words, this is going to be our Everest. And I said, allow me to show you the way.
Be my Sherpa, Sejan.
This is the peg to hang your coat on, right? Is the idea being, this is a genetically engineered Adam Sandler film. This was a Sandler film created in a lab. Somebody said, we like what that Sandler guy does, let's put him in a Disney movie. And then they went away before they even talked to Adam Sandler about it. Before that was even a thought in their mind. I have no doubt in my mind that there is just rooms and rooms and rooms of writers working for Disney, creating film concepts and like basic scripts, like pilot scripts, all of this shit, just with the intention of, hey, if we can ever get Brad Pitt on board, these are the movies that we're going to pitch him, right? And like those movies may never see the light of day. So this is probably not the only Adam Sandler movie that they wrote, but this was the one that they got him on board with to come on and do. But there was every step of the way they were thinking, how can we make this Adam Sandler-esque and keep it PG? That is exactly my feeling as I walk away from this movie.
You know, that's good to hear about these rooms and rooms, an entire building of writers working on content for Disney in case they get an actor. All those Warner Brothers Discovery layoffs from today, I'm sure they'll land on their feet there.
Yeah, but think about it this way. It's the same thing with news news companies, where it's some guy's job to pre-write obituaries for famous people and update them periodically.
I am reminded of a Dana Carvey sketch on SNL where Gerald Ford shot dead today.
Yeah. Oh, God. Man. Yeah, but exactly that, right, is the idea being like they've just got to have that shit on hand because it's first past the post with all of this sort of shit. So, like, they need to make sure that they are ready when they can finally do this thing. So, like, that is why you feel so cold and soulless. And the same applies for something like a Hocus Pocus 2. That was probably fucking just, like, written and rewritten and rewritten to shit just because of the fact that, like, they just wanted to get it right. And get it right to you and me might not necessarily mean the same as get it right to those people making those decisions, but you know.
I mean, we actually have proof of that with something like Hocus Pocus 2 when you consider there was already a sequel novel titled Hocus Pocus 2, and that, sorry to ruin this one for you, Sejan, is not the basis for the Disney Plus original. I just ripping the Band-Aid off right now. Good. I'm glad that we land on that same page. I will say this. This is a movie that I did not see in theaters. Sejan staunchly says that he saw this one in theaters. I specifically remember this being a film that the entire family sat down to watch on cable. Probably HBO. HBO seems like the place where this would have landed circa 2008, before the streaming wars really kicked off. Back when I think the only streaming town in town was Netflix. Right?
If there was even streaming, yeah, most people were probably still doing DVD.
Yeah, but I think that they were in their infancy becoming a streaming platform. So you have, especially since this comes out at the end of 2008. So my memory was sitting together as a family watching this film, and then honestly, I haven't thought about bedtime stories since that Saturday night where we watched it as a cable premiere. It's something I know I saw. There are moments that I remember. Just to like put it bluntly, that like just stick in my mind as, oh yeah, that's from bedtime stories. But the real thing that I take away from this movie the first time that I watch it is Courtney Cox is in it, and that was always kind of strange to me. And now that I've watched it also three times specifically for the show, the other thing that sticks with me is Aisha Tyler is in this.
Aisha Tyler is in it for like a scene.
Aisha Tyler is in it for the same number of scenes as Courtney Cox. And that's the craziest part about
it. I remember the restaurant scene. Does she show up somewhere else?
So she shows up in old Roman times.
Oh, right? I wasn't thinking about some of the flashback-y
story
stuff.
So that weirdly counts as a secondary scene. And then, spoilers for bedtime stories. Like, I hope you've watched the movie before you come to an episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. This is sort of like a book club where it's going to make a lot more sense if you've read the book. But luckily, it's not a book. It's an hour and 40 minute movie. So you can probably get through it like in a day, maybe two. Maybe you got a lost weekend you want to fill up. Watching Adam Sandler, listen to us talk about it. Might be fun. But she's a huge plot point. She's the resolution of one of the plot points in this film. And that's just like, oh, all right, I guess.
Yeah.
And she, at the time, is like a relatively new actor in Hollywood. Like,
she's been blowing it up on Whose Line, right? Like, isn't that where she's at this point?
Whose Line hasn't, I don't know. I mean, she's not hosting Whose Line until the 10s.
She wasn't a host at first, though. Let me tell you,
I did not know that. This is news to me.
I think that's how she got the hosting gig eventually, is because she did. I don't think that she did more than like a half a season with them. It was during that weird period when I think Wayne Brady is the one that decides that he wants to try and be, you know, bigger than Whose Line, and to his credit, succeeds.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm not, I don't need to make, I realized as I was saying that it sounded like I was shitting on Wayne Brady, and like, no, the dude is basically the Steve Allen of our time. But
currently on Disney Plus is Dancing with the Stars. Live every Monday. There's going to be a lot of Disney Plus in this one. There's not going to be another Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe where we can name check Disney as much as we can here. So just apologies in advance.
I think at some point she ends up as a competitor on it for a half a season, and then, you know, she's pretty loved. But when they come back and they don't have Drew, they turn to her for hosting duties. So long before she's hosting Whose Line, for sure. But I think at this point Aisha Tyler is at that perfect stage of blowing up,
right?
And we've talked about with Sandler movies before that being like pick of the litter for him sometimes, of like, let me get the guy that's right on the cusp because I can pay him a little less, get some real good work out of him, and a lot of new fans that would normally not come to an Adam Sandler movie will show up because of somebody. Now, I'm not saying there was like a drove that was going to tip the scale, but he's not stupid. Like, you don't bring somebody on that you don't think an audience is going to enjoy watching,
right? And actually, it makes me hope that she shows up in some other films with Adam Sandler. She hasn't in any of the ones we've covered yet, otherwise that. But, like, I think of her as Lana Kane in Archer. So to see her in this, like, live-action acting, I was very excited about that. Because, like, other than that, she's done, like, Balls of Fury, right?
Yeah,
so,
right.
Which, like, honestly, if your filmography was Balls of Fury, Bedtime Stories, I mean, that's a pretty good thing to hang your hat on. But yeah, and first impressions watching it again. I mean, Siegen kind of already said it. This episode kind of feels like my Everest. This is going to be a hard one for me to do, because watching it in 2022, I didn't really connect to it. And again, probably because of that soullessness that we're going to be exploring further on.
I don't think you connected to it in 2008 either, to be clear. Like, it
That's
sounds
true.
Like it
it's
didn't
not
really.
It's not one of those movies that I'm like, oh, I need to watch that again. You know how many times I've watched The Wedding Singer in 2022? Like 9.
Nice.
I used to watch it like every Saturday morning. It became my Muppets movie.
Also, so, on Disney Plus. How much further do we want to go before we clue the good folks in? Because we know that as much as we scold them, they don't watch it before they come to us.
Well, why don't we give them some facts and figures first so that they understand how this movie did before we tell them exactly what this movie is?
So I'm trying to remember if we did this off mic or on mic, but this is a movie that comes out on Christmas Day. Ta-da! 2008, December 25th. And
it's
not the only
birthday. This is our birthday episode of the ASCU.
for anybody that wants to place that, it is the same year as The Spirit, Valkyrie. Valkyrie's the really weird Tom Cruise one, right? Am I misremembering that?
Valkyrie is the Tom Cruise one where he's hunting down Nazis or
something like that. Curious Case of Benjamin Button and Marley and Me all come out with Bedtime Stories on this same day. That it is a fucking crazy ass release day. Only a week previously, the Jim Carrey classic Yes Man came out. 7 Pounds, the really weird Will Smith one that was all about like the weight of a human soul. Like, it is a really weird year for this movie to be coming out. This is 2008 was a weird year for movies in general, though, right? Like, that was the year of What's the Gran Torino, right? That was the
I
was
believe
the year
that
for
was 2008. I mean, 2008 is also the like birth
the
of
wrestler.
Superhero movies. You have Iron
Yep.
Man, you have Incredible Hulk, you have The Dark Knight. This is a weird time for cinema in general, which I think also kind of contributes to why we didn't get a Bedtime Stories trilogy, despite them feeling like they set up for it at the end of this movie.
Well, right, because the movie actually ends up doing pretty well for itself. Hold on, I skipped ahead to see what was on December 25th. So it's an $80 million movie, if you can believe it. I think that they get away with a lot with some of the fantasy scenes by not being like large stories, so they don't have to do like multiple sets and things like that. Also, a lot of stuff is CGI and not good CGI. That kind of thing is going on a lot in this movie. And so it's an $80 million film that ends up domestically passing that, $110 million. And then you go overseas with it and it doubles its money. So this movie pretty much is, I mean, by 2008 standards, pretty much a blockbuster film, right? Because it did more than double its budget while it was just in theaters alone. And then, you know, the thing with family movies is the legs on them afterwards. It's like, this is going to be a movie that this will be the movies that they can rent out to television channels to put on, that they can sell on DVD, all that sort of good shit. So it probably is they probably are kicking themselves that they didn't get more juice out of Sandler, but I also don't think anybody's disappointed to the fact where they feel like they wish they hadn't made this movie, right? I haven't heard of any terrible shit happening like behind the scenes on this film or anything like that. So as far as I know, everybody walked away also having a good time. But I mean, it does all right, right? Like, it comes out on Christmas, ends up making its money back. People remember it nice enough that this is also, I should say, as much as we're giving it shit, is the kind of movie that people don't really think about when they think about the Disney comedy or the Disney family comedy. With Sandler, they don't think about it either, but in neither case does anybody dislike it. Sandler fans that remember this movie are like, oh yeah, that's a weird one, like, I'll watch it if it's on. And Disney family folks are the same way, right? Like, nobody is, like, offended by this film to the point where it is, like, it is buried, right? It's not like Disney put it in the vault and never let it out again, that sort of thing.
Right. All I want to do is say Song of the South, I hate you, Seijin.
But it's that weird place where Sandler really kind of finds himself. To be entirely honest, they kind of got the Sandler result when all was said and done, is that it's not a movie that pleases a bunch of critics, but it made more than double its money back. So nobody's really complaining, which is like the Sandler special, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and especially after something like in 2007, Chuck and Larry and Reign Over Me, this is the safe bet for an Adam Sandler film. So for it to perform the way that it did, everybody should be happy. And
right.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I have a theory about it too, specifically about that whole genetic engineering. I'm not entirely unsure Adam wasn't in the lab at some point, overseeing it all, kind of like B.D. Wong in Jurassic Park.
I think you could definitely see that there were, like, it's the idea being of Disney definitely approaches him and says, we want to make a movie with you, right? Like, Sam, there's no way Happy Madison approaches Disney and says, hey, you guys want to make a movie, right? Like, maybe, but like, it really feels like that relationship has to go the other way. They come and they say, we have workshopped some thoughts, some, here are some ideas, which ones do you want us to go with, where would you like to see these things go? Yeah, he definitely is brought in on the process. But there is a process, and that's the important thing I think to remember when watching this movie, is that this is a movie that was made through a process of how films are made in the Disney machine, right? And I also don't want to be one of those guys that's just like, everything that Disney puts out is cold and soulless because it's all created by capitalist machines. I am not that kind of person. I love me a good Disney movie. I love me a bad Disney movie. I enjoy watching this movie because of the fact that it is manufactured for me to enjoy it.
If people give me 5 minutes of silence, you give me 5 seconds of silence, I will delight you with my TED talk on why The Pacifier has one of the best twists in cinema of the last decade.
All right. Yeah, exactly.
So I'm right there with you, but it's, I think it's different, especially for someone like you and I who have been studying Adam Sandler the way we have over the past 2 years. To like come to a film like this and be like, huh, how is this like his other movies? And then sort of be like, oh, well, I guess if we were going to be real sincere about it, this could kind of be Adam Sandler 101, this film.
Mm. Yeah. I think a very distilled, well-versed Sandler 101, right? Because I wouldn't compare this, well, I will compare this to Billy Madison later, and we'll talk about that, but I wouldn't compare the work going on to that, right?
Right. That's a good point. I guess it's kind of honors Adam Sandler 101. No. That's an important distinction and something that we will save for after I read this synopsis. 25 years ago, Marty Bronson sold his family-run business, the Sunny Vista Hotel, to Barry Nottingham. Per their deal, Nottingham promised there would always be a place for Marty's son at the hotel, and that if Skeeter Bronson worked hard and showed some smarts when he grows up, he will one day run the place. Now in present-day 2008, 31-year-old Skeeter is the handyman at the Sunny Vista Nottingham. While the favorite of the 23 Nottingham properties, that doesn't change the fact that it is a 20th-century hotel, and it is time to modernize, which Nottingham intends to do by closing the current location and opening a new Sunny Vista Mega Nottingham nearby, complete with new general manager, a role Skeeter expects to have earned, but a promotion current manager and fiance of Violet Nottingham, Kendall Duncan, instead receives. Meanwhile, Skeeter's sister Wendy is suffering her own disappointments. Freshly divorced, she has been laid off from her job as principal of Webster Elementary because they're closing the school down, leaving her with no choice but to ask her brother to watch her two children, Patrick and Bobby, while she visits Arizona in search of a new job. Despite having not been part of his niece and nephew's lives for the past 4 years, Skeeter agrees. Luckily, he only has to be responsible for the kids during the night shift, as Wendy's friend and fellow educator Jill Hastings has agreed to provide care during the days. The first night watching the children, Skeeter is horrified that the only stories available to read them at bedtime are educational, and decides to continue his father's tradition of telling a bedtime story made up on the spot. Initially, the children are enjoying the tale, but when Skeeter's depression bleeds into the narrative, the children step in to provide a happier ending. The next day, Skeeter is flabbergasted when the story he told his nibblings comes true, and Nottingham agrees to give him a chance to present why he should be the new general manager. Skeeter plans to further exploit the delirious magic of these bedtime stories for personal and professional gain, but his attempts are stymied when he discovers the only story elements introduced by Patrick and or Bobby come to pass, which isn't bad when it helps him realize that Jill is actually the fairest maiden in the land, but could prove deadly when they have him incinerated in an effort to give their story a more realistic ending akin to the first story Skeeter told them. Ultimately, be it through hard work or magical intervention, Skeeter proves victorious, earning the role of general manager and avoiding immolation. However, he does end up fired from his job after ruining Nottingham's birthday cake, which becomes a moot point when he realizes that the reason Wendy's school is closing is to make way for the new Mega Nottingham. Now it is a race to save the school and hopefully get the girl.
Yeah, I mean...
You muted yourself. I know specifically that you muted yourself.
I always mute myself when you read those.
I guess this is the time I felt it. I said nibbling, Seijin. That's some fancy Google work and a bit of the OED. Thank you very much.
But that's this movie pretty much tip to toe, right? And then interspersed throughout that is just weird moments for Sandler jokes to happen. And I do mean like Sandler jokes, because they're bits that I don't think are funny to anybody that doesn't care about like the Adam Sandler, honestly, cinematic universe, right? Like when what's his nuts shows up at the party at the end.
Oh, Jonathan Loughran completely just like sliding into this movie as a reference to Slider.
And with a joke that doesn't land, because it seems like it's a joke between friends that we weren't invited to the setup for.
Yeah, it's like it sort of feels like the origin of John Loughran and Adam Sandler's friendship is like after a show, John Loughran came and was like, "Man, it's real funny when you're like talking in that goofy gibberish."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Cool, you want to hang out?"
Yeah,
and they do, I guess. I don't.
But like the bit that, you know, our cold open of the night, right? Our covert when he shows up, and it's just like, why? Why is this scene in this movie? It does nothing for like the rest of the I mean, I guess it introduces the idea that he wants a nice car, but that's kind of a thing that already exists in everybody anyway. Like, I wouldn't have been offended if the desire for a nice car showed up later and it had not been set up. Like, I don't know. I don't believe that this guy likes nice things.
Yeah, it's that scene is very strange. I mean, it's a way to get Alan Covert in there, and
Right.
I mean, well, we I okay. You know what we do? We do this thing on the show, and I'm jumping into it. Like, usually we have a bit of a discussion here before we jump into it. All of my discussion, I find, is going to be related to it. So it's time for that tried and true Adam Sandler cinematic universe centerpiece. The thing I'm most proud of. It's called Something New, Something Old, Something Borrowed, Something Blue. And usually it's a way to kickstart conversation, but honestly, Sijin, I can't go any further without introducing my stuff because I'm just gonna blow through all of it. And I
Yeah,
have
sure enough.
multiple for almost everything.
Yeah, good, because yeah, good. We should talk about this.
All right, so I'm gonna be an asshole. I'm gonna go first. I'm gonna take new Walt Disney, working with Walt Disney. It's the first time Adam Sandler is working with Walt Disney, specifically Adam Sandler.
Oh, I thought you were going to say specifically Walt. They brought his head
They
in
brought his head
on a
in on
rolly
this one.
card and
This is actually based on Walt Disney's life. It's how he invented Oswald and Mickey and all the gang.
he
No,
stole them from a couple little kids.
yeah, it's but it is him working with Disney. And I bring that up here in the new, and because it is new, because it's Adam, but we're talking about the Covert Covert. We talk about other movies that Adam Sandler has done with someone like Steve Brill, and Steve Brill and Alan Covert have worked with Disney before. So, like, it also doesn't seem like it'd be that hard a sell to get Alan Covert in the film to, like, do that little scene that seems incredibly incongruous to everything else that's going on in Bedtime Stories.
For sure. Yeah. No, the other big thing that happens is Tim Herlihy, who we have talked about working with Sandler before, is in this movie. He shows up as the younger version of the old of Lancelot there. What's his name? Nottingham.
Really?
But
That's
he's
because everything says that it is Nottingham as the young and older version is played by
What?
Richard Burroughs.
No,
Not
Tim Hurley plays young. He's credited on IMDb, so I don't know what you mean by everything.
that's not like the Wikipedia. Like, I went through a bunch of Wikipedia pages today to try to find it because it didn't make sense to me. So I guess they're just quoting each other because I'm like, there's no
Yeah.
way that that's
No,
him
but
as the
he's
younger
also
Nottingham. But like,
So it's Tim Hurley, who was also on a second writer. So the other reason why it feels like Sandler might have been in the room for this is that if he wasn't, his little script goblin was. Right? Like, so Tim Hurley, he is also all over this movie. And again, so it makes sense why like some stuff is able to be slipped in there. Is when you have somebody on the inside like that, he's able to get these moments to pop, right?
right. I mean, because Matt Lopez is the drone that you spoke of in the Disney writer, detention center, who wrote this movie for Adam Sandler, and it's his script that's
I
chosen.
feel bad that I've introduced this negative aspect to this
It's
concept.
not,
I
no, I
just
mean, it's a thing that probably exists, but it's not trying to be negative. It's the fact that, like, if a script did exist, right? If Disney was asking for, if the Disney picture company was asking for scripts that could fit an Adam Sandler like role, right? Adam Sandler
Right.
would work in. This is the script that Matt Lopez wrote and presented, and then Adam Sandler is the one who goes, "Hey, is it all right if my buddy, takes another pass at it?" Like,
Yeah, for
that's what
sure.
it feels like. I mean, because the screenplay is by Matt Lopez and Tim Herlihy with story by Matt Lopez, so it feels like it's a situation where Tim Herlihy comes in. Really, Adam Sandler's up this film, and we know from other Tim Herlihy joints that Adam is in his ear on most of those changes. That, like,
You
they
know, or that
collaborate.
they share a similar sense of
Yeah.
comedy and style. I mean, like,
Yeah.
that's what it is, right?
Yeah. I don't mean anything negative by that. It's just one of those situations where we've seen them work together before, and if we're going to talk about the parts that feel like Adam was involved in, most of them probably did come from Tim Herlihy. But yeah,
Right.
this is the Disney one, but it's also a situation where you do have these guys who have worked with Disney. Someone like Steve Brill, who's done, I believe, four movies that I know of off the top of my head, with the Mighty Ducks trilogy and Heavyweights.
Yeah. Yep.
So so like those are people who are like, you know, Adam Sandler, like he would probably be willing to work for you. Alan Covert being the cameraman, Ben Stiller, and the fact that he and Adam Sandler like lived together briefly in the early 90s. Like, right. So it's not surprising that Adam would be on their radar. And also what's not surprising is that in 2008, after doing the like heartfelt drama and the like too late, like they just released it too late and didn't update the script properly, Chuck and Larry, that he would like finally be willing to take that meeting with Walt Disney.
Yeah. Also, he gets his kid to be in a movie with the character title of Sweetest Medieval Girl of All Time, played by Sadie Sandler.
And what is his wife credited as? Like, drunken peasant whore with Swedish child in all the land.
Who, Jackie?
Yeah.
No, Lady Jacqueline. he gets big family points getting them into Disney credits of that, right?
Yeah. It is nice. And it's such a... I mean, there's some subtle cameos in this movie, but I might be jumping ahead of myself. So that's my new... I'm totally an asshole for doing that, and I'm sorry. No.
Because my new was something completely different.
Oh, nice.
It's the British invasion, baby. I mean, like, it's not just British, it's also Australian, but like the number of outside people that are brought in, right? Like that is a Sandler staple. Like, let me get some really good, popular, famous people to like do an Adam Sandler movie, and people are gonna scratch their heads and be like, well, I gotta go see it. Dave Matthews is in this one for some reason, right? like that's the bit, right? Well, his poll this time seems to be a bunch of British actors, and that I think this is the first time that we've really seen him really dip into that well. You know, I think of like Russell Brand as being like kind of like the big, like, this guy is at the 2008, so he's extremely popular in the UK by now, but is he already done his whole Albus Snow deal with Forgetting Sarah Marshall, or is that later?
So it's the same year. Albus Snow is the same year.
So Russell Brand is in that I'm gonna go make American movies mode, and just is getting cast in Sandler movies and Judd Apatow movies, right? Like it's a perfect kind of
the former roommates, Judd Apatow and Adam Sandler.
But we also have Richard Griffiths, who is huge in this, right? Even to that point, kind of Jonathan Pryce, although I'm not quite sure where Jonathan Pryce hails from, but he's also kind of in that old-time actor that I'm going to get to really gussy up my film that Sandler likes to do. Yeah. But then you also have, as I mentioned, the whole Australia side of this, which is where you get things like Guy Pearce and Lucy Lawless and Teresa Palmer. Like they all end up coming over from that side of the pond. So he is going international with this one, man. Like, and it's interesting to see. I don't know if that's like a Disney thing where like they're able to go and say, hey, we're making a Disney movie, and so here's the big bucks, or if Sandler, this is just kind of his first time venturing out.
Adam Sandler said, look, I'll do bedtime stories, but if you're not going to allow me to go be on location with a bunch of my friends, you have to bring exotic locations to me. I would like actors from the following countries.
Yeah.
But
he still manages to then fit Nick Swardson in somewhere.
Of course. Well, they're best friends. Like, Nick Swardson's flame is burning hot in the Happy Madison camp right now. He's done Grandma's Boy. He's done Benchwarmers. He got to show up in Chuck and Larry. It makes perfect sense that, like, Nick Swardson, he's the soup of the day right now in Adam Sandler's films. And it's a perfect role for Nick Swardson as the head of the demolition team. But yeah, this cast is so international.
But Nick Swardson, just while we're talking about it, because I don't think we'll talk about him again since the scene is so short, but he has one of the sweetest moments in this whole movie when he's basically just like, nah, I'm not gonna blow school with his kids inside, and then he gets hit punched by Guy Pearce. Like, he has a clear voice of reason moment in this movie for the two lines he has.
Yeah. Like, no, we gotta check the school again.
I love blowing shit up, but not if there's a kid inside.
Yeah, like, come on. Yeah, he's Nick Swardson, and he's on the rise too. Same with like Russell Brand. And I gotta tell you, as God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly, and I didn't know Teresa Palmer was an American. I'm a big Teresa Palmer fan. You give me Take Me Home Tonight. You give me the Point Break remake from 2015. She kicks ass in those roles. She's from Adelaide, South Australia.
I knew I wasn't out of my mind.
No, you're not out of your mind. Because hearing her voice in this movie, I'm like, oh, wow, I never put that together. And also one of the reasons why I would never put it together is I forgot that she was in this movie.
Yeah.
I forgot that the Violet Nottingham character even exists.
And that's interesting because as far as I can tell, she's kind of the most interesting character in this whole movie. Like, even above Skeeter, like Adam Sandler's character, like I find Teresa Palmer's character of Violet really intriguing specifically because of how kind of like unstereotypical, what's the word I'm looking for? Like she's very trope breaking as a character for who she is in this film. Like where she could have gone and like what you would have expected from somebody at this time writing a character like that, they don't ever really go there with her.
Yeah,
Like
she brings a fresh performance and a fresh take to what would be like she's playing Paris Hilton, right? Without like being a total jerk.
well,
Oh,
that's what I mean is
yeah.
she in the first moments you meet her think that's exactly where that character's going to go,
Right.
and like you know all of the little details are there as well as all of like some of the vocal cues and things like that, the stuff that she talks about for sure in that first moment you're meant to think that. I don't think that's a mistake, but then they like immediately start like fleshing her out as just like actually a very good like businesswoman and that takes care of just herself as her product. Like it's a really interesting move for that character.
She's very human for a character that feels like on the page was meant as a one-off stereotype
And
joke.
for a movie that has no need, it has no reason to break that trope, like other than you know to be a better movie, but like it's wild that this is where somebody started to kind of spread their wings a bit and like explore this kind of shit. It's like okay, all right, points to you on that one.
I mean, it also. There's a little bit of reasoning behind it because there's for a hot second in this movie, at least in stories two and three, you're supposed to think that she is the love interest for Adam Sandler's character. And
I mean,
she checks
she's
all
the
the
red hair.
boxes of that. Like
Well,
that.
she's the red herring love interest, which we've seen many times in Sandler movies. There's always the red herring love interest for Sandler that then he realizes the real love interest, who the real love interest is. That's not, we didn't make it a Sandler trope because it didn't come to fruition till later films. But I mean, like, look at, just go with it, right? Or there's definitely other examples of this that I would need to dive into. Again, it's not one of our tenets for a
Well, it's
reason,
certainly
but
not
it.
one of our tenets for a reason, but then, like, I was gonna say, give me an example, but you saying something like bedtime stories, no, just go with it. That is a perfect example and enough for me to say there's precedent here in movies that we've looked at. I'm sure it exists in other films as well. I mean, it sort of does it in, micro with the whole thing of,
It's the whole plot of Spanglish. Sorry,
yeah,
go ahead.
his ex-fiance in The Wedding Singer. When she shows up in the third act to make Julia think that they're back together, like it kind of tracks. You're not like I was gonna say you're completely wrong, but also it feels like in this film that I bet we're about to talk about celebrates all of the tropes of Adam Sandler. Once we get to old, it is one of those situations where one of the criticisms that was levied against him is he's getting all these young girls to be
Yeah.
his love interests in these movies. Where
Right.
like then oh then and Carrie Russell is the bitch character who is also someone that's existed in movies. Look at Leslie Apatow, I can't think of her last name.
Oh, Leslie Mann.
Leslie Mann in something like Big Daddy. And the fact that like there exist two types of women in an Adam Sandler film, the love interest and the bitch.
Right.
And that is And this is an interesting film to take that trope and completely flip it on its head. Like I wouldn't have, I
Yeah.
wasn't expecting it, especially as somebody who just flat didn't remember this movie. I did have
Yeah,
just
yeah. Yeah, it's an expansion on the girlfriend from Happy Gilmore as well, right? In the beginning, he has this girlfriend that he is d just not treating well, so she leaves him, rightly so, and then we're supposed to like somehow feel bad for her at the end of the movie when he's not with her anymore. I don't know. It's like no, she was doing the right thing. You were being kind of a prick.
Yeah, it's an interesting one right there. Cool. I love it. I support everything. It is. This is the probably the most international cast and one of the most diverse casts as well, with someone like Aisha Tyler showing up, because I can't think of
Yeah, I
many
mean,
actors
like
of color who aren't
you
Chris
start
Rock. So,
right. You start to think about movies that he has done in other places, right? Like
yeah.
Blended when they go to Africa or 51st Dates, basically the Drew Barrymore ones, right? That's not fair. Also the Jennifer Aniston ones. He's got some good international cred once he starts going international as a character, but this is the first time where he is very much being in this homegrown American comedy, and we're just surrounding ourselves in some pretty heavy hitters. I mean, come on, Guy Pearce.
I had to be like, that's not Guy Pearce. Is it? That can't be Guy Pearce. And then I'm like, it is though. It's Guy Pearce, Devin. That's
Who's
Adrian Killian. Like,
clearly having a fun time, especially in the any role that is not the main Kendall role, right? Anytime he is like Sir Douchebag or whatever he is, or like the evil
Sir
space lord,
Buttkiss.
yeah, like he's
Kendallo.
always looking like he's having a good time.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that this was probably a blast to work on this film. It's just that sometimes when you're having fun, that doesn't necessarily translate to, the best product. Even though this one made three times its budget, so what do I know? All right,
I
so
mean,
let's.
Guy Pearce doing a Broadway number by the end of this film, like, it's phenomenal. We get an actual evil villain song out of a, it. That's the Disney to your Adam Sandler, like, right? That's the Disney peanut butter to your Adam Sandler jelly, is that we are given a full-on Guy Pearce musical moment at the end of this movie.
That's a very good point, Sejun. All right, let's move into the old, and I will allow you to pick from the smorgasbord that I believe is on display.
How are we not going to talk about the fact that he is once again a young son of a hotel owner that is now competing for ownership of said hotel? It is so, like, they went so deep into the Sandler DNA that they just started pulling out specific bits from old movies.
Yeah, to the fact that it's almost surprising that it's not Gordon who is the
Right.
villain. Like it was
Right. They basically give him the same haircut with a little bit more gel.
yeah, he's a 2000 Eric Gordon. He's also not as like morally ambiguous. Like at the end of the day, I don't think Kendall is downright evil. He's like blinded by ambition.
He does almost blow up a building with two little kids inside. I
Nobody
like I
knows
will
the
give
kids
you
are
that he
inside. If he
I
could
will give you
see the
that there is
kids and
a
said it.
thin There is a thin layer. Like, hey, I'm gonna crisp up these steaks. Well, you just put a little bit of olive oil in the pan so it doesn't burn. That little thin layer of safety in that he is ignorant of the fact they are actually inside. Everybody else is like, we should still check, dumbass. And he's like, no, daddy, no.
Right. But let's talk about the fact that, like, he wavers. Eric Gordon takes the detonator, he just blows up the school. He don't tell a little speech or nothing
Oh,
like that.
no, he would have made some coy comment about just like two less kids in the world. Some shitty, like creepy ass like comment that would have just like, what the fuck?
Well, I believe that children are our future.
Yeah, that's
Boom.
terrifying implications to that thought
Yeah,
process.
right? Progress, baby. You're not gonna build
I like
a
that we've just turned Eric Gordon into basically the bad guy from True Lies.
a movie I still need to see. I'm sorry, Siege. That's my birthday gift to you, is an admission that I've never seen True Lies.
It doesn't really offend me that much. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I thought you, Devin. I feel like you thought this was gonna be a bigger moment. It's really
I
not.
think the only thing that really disappoints me is I don't know if it really hit you as hard as it should have in Captain Marvel when she fucking blows up the True Lies standee.
Oh, I lost my
Like.
mind when that happened. It was perfect. I just, but that's because I worked at a Blockbuster and also blew up a True Lies standee. Memories. Yeah, that's a yeah. The fact that one of my notes watching this film was, on one level, I'm upset that it's not the Madison Hotel Group, but on another level, I wouldn't want the Madison Hotel Group to be the villains, which
Right.
Nottingham clearly is in this film. They
Right.
take on the villainous role. So it's if Billy hadn't taken over and it was Eric Gordon, it would make sense. But like Billy Madison happened, guys. And
Yeah.
that's just a fact.
Oh, man. Yep.
So that was my number one. I mean,
I
crocodile
mean,
eating the peasant, that's Billy Madison.
Straight up, the silly voice moves. The number of times they need to justify him using a silly voice is ridiculous because we have been watching Sandler movies for decades at this point where he puts on silly voices and never questioned it. In fact, we're quite tickled when he would do it with no explanation. So, like, them trying to find justification for Sandler to get him to use silly voices in this movie is amazing.
Because Skeeter Bronson is a straight up fella. He's not the kind of person who goes like the I mean, like, and he is though. It's totally there, like the for free. it's there's that. I mean, Rob Schneider comes in and he says, "I can do it." Like it's
right.
I mean, he plays there's a like terrible straight up just stolen moments. Like it is.
Yeah.
There is so much just taken from it. I guess the one that I'm going to mention though, the one I'm going to go on record for, is the nice nod to Dylan and Cole Sprouse and the fact that the TV show that they're watching is The Suite Life of Zack and Cody.
Excellent.
Like that
phenomenal.
Is
yeah.
Like that's one of those moments where I'm like, first of all, you have to have watched The Suite Life of Zack and Cody to catch it at the beginning, because it's right. Like Irvin or Irwin who's yes. on the screen, and I'm just like, what the frick show are they watching? And then it's the freaking jetpack episode of Suite Life of Zack and Cody, and I'm like, oh, it's the jetpack episode. Oh, that's nice. Like, that has to have been Adam saying, can we put on anything that you guys have? Because it'd be nice to name check, like, kind of the reason why I'm here, right? Like, you want to put me in a film with two kids is because of Big Daddy.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
Like, I'm going to, it's the old is that it's building on Big Daddy, and he actually, you know, face checks. Is that the phrase there? The Sprouse twins with Zach and Cody.
No, they get like slant cameos. It's pretty cool. Yeah, I like it.
All right. Excellent. But yeah, it is like everything from old Adam Sandler movies comes. And this is where I want to say this in a lot of ways to me feels like the antithesis of Little Nicky. In just like sort of the worst way possible, if that makes sense. Where like I love Little Nicky, I will scream it from the rooftops how much I love the film Little Nicky. This film feels like, all right, Little Nicky didn't work to establish this shared universe that I was trying to present to people. Maybe the reason why it didn't work was because of the overtones and the fact that it's so religious and it is such a taboo topic that we're exploring in something like Little Nicky, as I try to kind of unify all of the films that came before it. So let's do the cleanest, most sanitized Walt Disney version of a Little Nicky shared universe. But he doesn't bring in any of the characters because he doesn't want to lose them to Walt Disney.
Are you
Disney.
Calling this your borrowed? Is that they basically have borrowed?
Oh, no. This is my old. This is all my old. Because it does a lot of the greatest hits stuff. I mean, the fact that it's basically the plot of Billy Madison is insane. The fact right. that so many bits are lifted from, like, really movies from the beginning. The journey playing when he's victorious in the medieval story. Like, that just feels like The Wedding Singer. Like, there's like...
Oh. I mean, even the whole breaking the fourth wall eventually, because eventually this movie goes fucking whole hog into the magic, and we'll talk about the magic of there. He starts talking to the narrator, and all I could think of are those moments towards the end of Happy Gilmore once again, where he's looking up and seeing everybody in heaven and waves to them, right? Like, I mean, and it's like, oh, we've just openly admitted that we are in this magical world now. Okay.
I mean, he's like breaking the 16th wall at one point when he looks at the camera and talks to me within the story. That is the story. Like, I'm just like, what is the inception level here? I feel like we're pretty close to the shore. I don't really understand that movie inside.
Everybody spin your tops. We need to get out of here.
Is that it? Spinning the top wakes them up? I know that's
not
how the movie works. I know that's...
I was getting it wrong on purpose.
I get it. It's a very Adam Sandler referenced joke. I'm proud of you. All right.
Oh, man.
So I'm going to take borrowed, and then you can go first on blue. For my borrowed, I'm going to go, this is my secret, Flash Gordon. You know, I offended Sam Jones at New Orleans Wizard World.
when
I called him Flash Gordon. We were just like walking, leaving the convention center. We had been hanging out with some of the friends from the Ninja Turtle stuff, Dale and I. And then like they shut down the convention hall. Like we were not supposed to still be in there as like non-exhibitors or anything like that. And I wound up like just standing in the way of Sam Jones. And I'm like, oh, excuse me, Flash Gordon. And Dale goes, or Sam Jones, or like you could call him that. And the look that I got from Sam Jones that day when I called him Flash Gordon when he was on his time, it has resonated with me, probably because when I went to Super Mega Fest, which is like one of those celebrity signing conventions that happens in like central Massachusetts, Sam Jones was there and he remembered me and gave me the same look. Like, I'm like, I didn't think that I was going to be your modern Emperor Ming, Sam Jones. I'm sorry. So for Nottingham, in the clearly inspired by like Star Wars sci-fi story, the fourth story is dressed like Emperor Ming from Flash Gordon. Like, right. That just makes me so like that again feels like one of those things that comes from Adam. That feels like he's like, can he be dressed like Emperor Ming from, can we do that? Well, like,
and it's kind of like that through all of them, right? Like the ways in which it's so referential to things, including Sandler stuff, but outside of Sandler stuff, there's Indiana Jones moments. There's some really good, there's a couple of moments where I was like, this is like straight up True Grit for a second when they're running backwards through the thing to get away. There was a lot of really just like really great movie moments that are not specific movies. So I kind of had a hard time with Borrowed because it's not like specific things. Like the whole attitude of the Disney, I don't know why 90s was replacing Disney there, in the Disney family comedy, right? Like specifically like action comedy, because I think about all the old Kurt Russell ones.
Yeah.
They used to, like, the computer wore tennis shoes and shit like that, right? Like those kind of goofier, sillier ones where it wasn't about like big musical numbers. It was really more about just like weird sci-fi with no real justification and maybe science is magic, kids, and like that kind of stuff. And you just get that feel throughout the whole thing. But yeah, I totally get like specific moments as well.
Yeah. Do you have a specific Borrowed that you want to put on the book though, or?
I mean, it's hard for me to pick. But what I actually ended up falling on every time was the Adam Sandler shtick. Like, I feel like that's the Borrowed material for this movie, because if you remove kind of the Adam Sandler stuff, there's still a movie here, a movie that will stand on its own, and you could just insert another actor and make this movie. Like the way that Adam Sandler is layered upon this film is almost like icing on a cake, and you could remove that and still eat the cake underneath, right? Like there's so I actually, my Borrowed for this is a bunch of the Adam Sandler shtick of it all.
That's, I like that. I kind of dig that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, feels like that should fall under the old, but. Based on what new old Borrowed is. But
because I don't even mean just from old movies like or anything like that we've seen before. I mean like going into even some of his like character work and like his CDs and stuff. They wanted just the whole oeuvre. I guess if I was gonna say one movie that I feel they heavily borrowed from that we've seen so far, I don't know if it's actually come out yet in the grand scheme of things, but would be Funny People, right? Like the ways in which what we're seeing here feels very much like a lot of the stuff that he is fighting against when he plays his character that he plays in Funny People.
So Funny People is the next year, and holy fuck, can I see how Bedtime Stories led to Funny People on the evolutionary chart of Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
Like, woof, what a thing. What a statement. I have a bonus. I have a bonus, and it's kind of just for you and me. And specifically what we've been doing over on the Say Report, I'm sorry to let it bleed in a little bit, but also, like, we're about to record our 300th episode of the Say Report, so it's kind of hard to get away from it. So if you're enjoying us on one hyper-focused topic like Adam Sandler, why don't you check us out on the Say Report? That one happens weekly. For you and for me, as we, in the Say Report, are celebrating 15 years ago, the movies that made us, the movies that we saw together, we've talked about it on our Chuck and Larry episode. Do you remember the movie we saw with Chuck and Larry?
With Chuck and Larry, would that have been like The Queen?
It was
Hairspray. It was Hairspray. Yeah.
So the fact that in Adrian Killich's, I'm sorry, I don't even know his name in Iron Man 3. That's what I was trying to go for there. The fact that in his villain song, there is a girl dressed like Nikki Blonsky, specifically like Nikki Blonsky's Tracy Turnblatt from Hairspray, that released the same weekend as I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, felt like such a reference to people who might have seen those two movies at the same time. Yeah. Like, it, and I'm just like, and the weirdest thing about it is all of the Broadway stuff that they check in that scene is credited at the end of the credit, at the end of the film during the credits, but not Hairspray. But like specifically the logo for Hairspray, the movie, the one that was on like the original trailer, like original posters, is one of the ones on the Broadway Mega Nottingham that Kendall presents. And she's dressed like that. So like it's kind of a bonus borrowed that might only appeal to you and I, who are people who have been like focused in on 2007 and one specific weekend of 2007. But I would have felt remiss if in the borrowed I didn't mention it.
I will mention that down lower in my notes. I do have a joke that I had written down that I did not intend to tell, but all I wrote was at one moment, and you'll know the moment when I say it, I wrote, Ben, I don't know why. That was the like laugh that came out of me when I watched that moment with like the entire Ben-Hur scene of him in the chariot race. But there you go. There's a good borrowed moment that kind of points to what I was talking about, where they just kind of sprinkle just little shit in everywhere. But then what they do is then they just, after they sprinkle all of this like really good Hollywood and Disney stuff all over it, they then spread a nice thick layer of Adam Sandler and then they spoon feed it to you for an hour and a half.
That's I'm down for it. I do love it. Ben-Hur, you fucking jerk. That's gonna just be stuck in my head, and it's just a phrase you said, you monster. All right, let's get to our favorite one to fight about, Blue. What's your Blue in this movie, Sejun?
Gold Schneider shows up just to offend for just two moments in this movie, just to be really weirdly, oh, I guess three moments, right? Because he shows up in one of the flashbacks. I keep not counting the stories,
the bedtime like stories of,
yeah, I keep not thinking about them as moments where people could be like different characters, because he shows up as what we learned to be a criminal. I don't want to say that he's a homeless man, although I think that's implied by us later than seeing him riding the trains, right? Which is the second scene I was thinking of, but then I forgot that he also shows up as an Indian chief, of course, in the bedtime story with the cowboy that Sandler tells. That
bedtime
that
story
tells.
Number two.
So I just of like. Like, so much did they really want to make an Adam Sandler movie that they couldn't even deny that it is deep in the DNA that Rob Schneider. I wrote Bobby Schneids in my notes, so that's what I want to keep saying.
Oh man, my theater history teacher would fail you on the spot for not crediting him with his full title. I almost said his name, but I don't need to blow up.
Sir Robert Schneider,
father of L. King Robert Schneider.
That's, I mean, yes. Yep. Man. So he just shows up just to do his thing, and his thing is wildly offensive. And then he's gone again.
And my
riding the rails to my next cameo. I'll upset you then.
So questions about that. I'm a little happy you brought that one up, but there's also a reason why I wanted you to go first on Blue. The nose. Do you think it's just a prop for prop's sake, or does it play?
The nose, like his fake nose, his
fake nose in the bedtime story that you've forgotten. So already the entire bit is starting on shaky ground.
Yeah, I mean, no, none of it does, man. I mean, like even when it goes back to real world, I guess I will put quotes around that for now. Real world version of him where he's just like, I guess a hippie in the real world as opposed to a straight up Indian stereotype in the bedtime story.
I don't know. He's wearing a leather jacket with like Navajo pattern.
I guess I'm trying really hard to give them any benefit of the doubt, and I really shouldn't be.
The benefit
right?
of
like,
the doubt you give them is the fact that Disney said Rob Schneider can show up as a horrendous stereotype, but we're not crediting him. We'll wait to do that with Johnny Depp as Tonto. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. No, Devin, it's fine.
And
that
cannibal
army
hammer.
He spent 7 days living with one specific tribe, so that allows him to speak for all native peoples, all right?
Oh, just like George C. Scott or something. Who denied their Oscar? That's not important. That's not this show. Sorry.
Marlon Brando.
It was Marlon Brando. But, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, the Rob Schneider of it, that's, you're not wrong there. And the prop for prophecy. But I gotta say, I have to say something. Even though Rob Schneider plays just a host of offensive stereotypes, on some level, I gotta commend the guy for putting in the work. Because he never plays two stereotypes the same. But that's not what I want to talk about here today. What I want to talk about here today is the way that we approach the term blue, right? Just for sake of it, I'm going to say my blue, my official blue on record blue, is the Covert Covert seed. It is the bluest seed in an Adam Sandler movie ever. For some reason, Alan Covert's cameo character is driving a blue Ferrari. Which, honestly, I didn't even friggin' know they made blue Ferraris.
I was like, that has to be a toy, right? And I was like, that can't be a real Ferrari.
Like, I saw that blue Ferrari, and I'm like, what type of car is this? And then, like, it's such a big deal that it's a Ferrari, and I'm just like, do they do those in blue? Can we also do these in blue? It was just crazy. But then his whole outfit is blue. The woman he is with is decked head to toe in blue. And then it is what happens before a blue gumball rains down from the sky.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like, this is the bluest scene in any Adam Sandler movie. This is what I have been searching for. And blue is kind of like the accent color of bedtime stories because, again, built in a lab, and blue is the color of Adam Sandler. But all of that aside, right, there's my actual blue. That's the one on record. That's the one that if this ever comes out as, like, an advanced compendium that you can buy on Amazon for $17 on the next Prime Day they add, will be the one listed under bedtime stories as my blue is the Covert Covert scene. But, Sijin, I have a real, real problem with this film stripping away the agency of female characters because of the whims of a childhood bedtime story. Like, uncomfortable. To a level of uncomfortability that, like, one of the reasons why this became such a higher and higher summit for us to climb. Because Kerry Russell's Jill Hastings character, who I think the only time that we've really mentioned her at all was briefly in the synopsis, the fact that she's supposed to be at work, but because Patrick said the fairest maiden of in the land, and he was thinking of her at that time, she decides on a whim to go to the beach. Like, that is such an uncomfortable moment for me. And then it's exacerbated by the fact that all of the women who were ever mean to Skeeter in high school are just randomly together at this bar talking about him and then act completely out of character to the fact that because Patrick said they all randomly did the hokey pokey, they start doing the hokey pokey. It is.
Yeah, we've seen this kind of manipulation before, and it was in Cabin in the Woods. And all I can think of is all of those moments in that movie where people would do something that was out of character for them, and either themselves or people around them would be like, why are you acting like this? This is not how you normally... Like, they would call it out in that movie, and I just wanted somebody in this movie to do that once.
Like, it's just... It's so uncomfortable. And the thing that I thought of, right, probably funny man from the 90s, is The Mask, and how, like, the Cuban Pete scene... It's like, oh, he's just making that woman sing. But then it's like, no, but it's like a little darker than that, right? Like, he has completely stolen away this woman's agency for the bit. And it's not funny. And in the guise, when you're watching it through the eyes of, oh, this is a Disney family-friendly ha-ha little romp, maybe you don't think about that. But watching it as a 36-year-old man in the year 2022, all of those sequences made me hyper-uncomfortable.
It is really weird, right? Like, it's now is the time where we have to talk about whether or not magic exists in this film, right? Like, this is a honest to God conversation we need to have about this movie, because this movie kind of wants to have its cake and eat its too when it comes to magic, right?
Yeah,
like it is always trying to give you reasons why, like, it's trying to ground in reality the reason why a thing might happen, when magic is clearly the reason it happened.
Yes.
Right? Like, the gumball scenes is a perfect example of this. It completely throws me for a loop every friggin' time. Because all of a sudden, magically, gumballs rain from the sky. And it's like this magical scene where you're like, oh no, something has broken. What's gone wrong? And I'm starting to think back. I was like, did he touch the totem at the wrong time? Like, did they both pee in the fountain at the same time? What happened? Like, what has caused this crazy Freaky Friday mix-up? And I can't think of anything. And then they pull back to reveal, oh no, there's a candy truck just above his head that has crashed and is spilling gumballs everywhere. And it's like, oh, okay, so magic isn't real and that was just a coincidence. But then I was like, oh, but that's a hell of a coincidence because the kid says it and then it happens. Like, that's still pretty fucking weird, right? And then, like you're pointing out, we are kind of led to believe that whatever the kid says is going to take place. And the kid is starting to say some pretty manipulative, horrendous shit that could happen to people. Like, in other hands, this could be a horror movie.
Yeah, I mean, like there is a Goosebumps book that is exactly that. I
Isn't there
mi
a Twilight Zone episode that is that, where like the
Yep.
kid makes everybody do everything and like puts them in the cornfield?
And I mean, if you heard it in my synopsis, I checked the movie Delirious with John Candy, where he is inserted into a soap opera and essentially a god of that world because he has his typewriter. Also, something like Stranger Than Fiction. Like, that's another movie that I thought of was something that I could have gone for borrowed, but it doesn't feel as like there's like grounding in that movie. The fact
Well,
that Stranger Than Fiction is
Stranger Than
so
Fiction
grounded.
specifically,
Yeah.
yeah, and Stranger Than Fiction specifically, and Delirious to this point, I should say, are both movies that use that and then question that exact thing, right? The authority, the power that is at play there. Like, those movies are specifically centered around then questioning those abilities and bringing, and examining that. This movie never questions the ability that these kids have. There's never a moment where he's like, you have to be very careful with these powers that you clearly have, because they're clearly superpowers, right?
They might be the first X-Men in a Disney movie. Sorry.
No, it was good. I appreciated it.
But yeah, it is just, it is. Yeah, magic is that situation. And I guess where I come from, right, not to blow up whether or not this is in the ASCU at all, is the fact that this is a story that Marty Bronson is telling his 6-year-old son, Skeeter. I don't believe that any of this actually happens. I think that all of this is a story. The fact that Marty is narrating from the beginning, and the fact that, like, there's a moment where Adam Sandler speaks to his father about what's happening in the story, like, it really feels like, first of all, I'm a big fan of this new thing that I've discovered, and what we can talk about it later in an actual Slay Report setting of subtle sadness. Skeeter and Wendy, their mom has to be dead, right? There's no
I mean, it's a
mention of
Disney
a
movie, so
mom.
yes,
So it's a Disney
of
mom.
course.
So of course they fridge the mom. But like it is, so like that's not talked about. And then in the story, like Bobby and Patrick, their father, he's gone because of the divorce, but the way they talk about him and the way that people approach it, I don't know what he did. Like, it feels like he might be in jail. The
Yeah,
way
no,
that,
there's
like.
definitely some weird elements. I mean, to the point where, like, we're told that he got violent with Skeeter. And, like, in the moment, it sounds like Skeeter's just a terrible guy that brings that out of people. But by the end of this movie, thinking back on that, no, somebody that got physical with a guy like Skeeter, like, clearly had some other things that they needed to work on, right? Like he's definitely got his, he definitely knows how to push people's buttons. But there is never a point in this movie where he pushes someone to the point of, like, physical altercation.
I mean, he almost pushes a Kendall to that point with the weird "give me that cheesecake" scene. I don't want to talk about it any further than the fact that it exists, because Kendall in that moment is like being hyper defensive, and the reason he's being hyper defensive feels like it's related to Violet and the fact that he thinks that Skeeter is cued into the same thing that he's on, where if he gets close to the boss's daughter, the nepotism will kick in. And like that's another thing, like I want to love Skeeter as this hyper kind character. He's kind hearted, he cares about others. Like a beautiful thing that has no reason to exist in bedtime stories is the fact that Mrs. Dixon, the woman who checks in the past, is the woman who is saying a leprechaun stole from her mini bar.
yeah.
in the future.
Yeah, and he pays for all of her stuff.
And he pays for
right?
it because,
yeah.
like, he's known this woman for 25 years. And
yeah.
and it's like just this really nice moment where he does it. And then I think about the scene where, like, with Jill, he's a little bit judgy with her. But then you also need to understand the fact that his entire life has been a class struggle, and Jill Hastings, for better or for worse, slots into that group of people that Skeeter has always felt he has to fight against. Aspen and Kendall. These like it's so, and that's why, like, the Prius.
It does that. It does that weird sitcom-y bullshit of, like, they come from different backgrounds, but they can, like, he drives a big old truck and she drives a Prius, but they'll find love. Is like, I don't love that trope in particular, but again, that's where some of the Disney machine kind of comes into play. Like, they just pull on a couple of common strings there, right?
Yeah.
To make this puppet dance. Now I've thought about Pinocchio, and I don't want to get into another Tom Hanks conversation. That's for the Say Report. But the idea being that is clearly present, right? Like you were saying, there's this, like, class struggle aspect to it. I think of the ways in which his relationship with Wendy, that's Courtney Cox, right? Wendy,
yeah, his sister.
It's really weird in this movie. It culminates into something really nice. By the end of this film, I was actually really pleased with some of the stuff that they do in this movie, because they never quite meet each other in the middle, but they do learn to respect each other's path, right? Like, there is something really, really interesting about that, at least. But it starts off with, even from the moments of the flashback of them as kids, where Wendy is just set up as just being just completely divorced from her brother and father. And as you're saying, there's no mother present. So, like, she is also just kind of completely removed from all of the action and just treats him kind of like crap. And then flash forward to then Courtney Cox playing her, and she's not nice to him. She's not nice to a lot of people in those scenes when she's around at first.
That is such a weird, like, principles are monsters with the whole, oh, what job would you? Cuban dictator or the boogeyman? You want to be the boogeyman? Like, it's like, oh yeah, because elementary school principals are monsters. Weird yeah. flex there. Bedtime stories that doesn't make sense. The other thing is, now, you and I, we both have siblings. We both have pretty good relationships with our siblings. Let's pretend Zach or Dale were married to somebody, and that somebody we got into a physical altercation with. Could you go 4 years without talking to your blood because of the person they're with? Like, that's such a weird thing in this film.
Yeah, I just for clarification, not because I think it's better or worse one way or the other, but is it that they haven't talked for 4 years, or they just haven't seen each other? Like, have they called each other on the phone or anything like that?
I mean, it feels like they haven't interacted for 4 years. Maybe yeah. a phone call here or there, but the fact that she's like, she seems like she's been so busy in a bad marriage that, like, time has lost all meaning to her, because she's like, oh, it hasn't been that long, and it was 4th of July.
Yeah, she also doesn't realize that it's been 4 years, right?
Yeah, like the fact that he's like, she goes, it hasn't been that long, it was 4th of July, and he's like, yeah, 4th of July 4 years ago when I punched your ex-husband in the face.
Right.
Like, and then, and that's such, like, a nice thing, too, is that, like, all right, well, I want things to work out, so I'll take a step back from this, right? Maybe it is me. Skeeter identifying himself as potentially the problem in his sister's marriage to this guy who just sounds like a real fucking winner. And it's, and, like, so that's the type of stuff he does. So then when it gets to the point where, like, he's been a hard worker, we've been told, for the last 25 years, and, like, immediately he's going to take the shortcut of the magical bedtime stories, feels so out of character for him, especially because it's introduced kind of late in the movie. Like, there's a lot of buildup before magical bedtime stories happen in this movie about magical bedtime stories. And magical bedtime stories are all wrapped up, and for some reason, there's still 25 minutes left of movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, they have to figure out what to do with the pig with stigmatism, whatever the fuck was going on with that guinea pig. That they also, there's a lot of little jokes and bits like that just kind of exist in this film that kind of go nowhere. And I don't know who to blame for that. I don't know if it's a Disney thing or a Sandler thing, or maybe it's something they both do and it's just a convenient thing, right? Because I think of that joke, right? I think of the running bit of the guinea pig with the
when
with
did
the big
G-Force
corn ears.
Come out? That's my question.
That's a good one. I think 2006.
I know. That's what it feels like. like a remnant of G-Force. Like,
but then the other bit that really doesn't do much other than to serve for a couple of jokey moments and just kind of give something to Russell Brand to do is the sleep problem that he has. What do they call it?
Sleep panic disorder.
I'm legally obliged
to tell you I have sleep panic disorder.
Okay. It feels like they let him improvise that earlier, and then they were like, well, now we got to keep this up for the rest of the movie. Thanks a lot, Russ.
Well, it works, though. Like, it's one of the only callbacks in this film that works. Also, but,
define works for me, please.
So he says that he has sleep panic disorder, and then when Jill comes to pick up the kids, he's sleeping on the couch, and he just sits up and screams, "I'm innocent!"
It appears, but that adds nothing to that scene.
Right.
It does not move plot forward. It does not add anything there. I would not call that working. I would say it appears.
It confirms that he actually has the disease. It is an improv line. I'll give you that it's probably an improv line because it's Russell Brand. So then it comes up and they say, well, we're going to go with it. So they admit that he has it. And then when he's like a commoner sitting next to Barry Nottingham at the end of the movie, when he falls asleep during the Broadway thing, it's a really nice way to tell us, the audience, that he was so bored he fell asleep. And the only reason he's awake is his sleep panic disorder.
That's not enough for me, I guess. It's on the same page as the guinea pig with giant eyes, where people keep commenting on it. It keeps coming up, and eventually, like we learn to love him for it, I guess. But really, it adds nothing to the movie. It doesn't do anything for the movie, right?
I mean, it adds a funny animal pet. It's Iago. It's the chicken from Moana. It's a Disney trope, my brother.
I think it's also a Sandler trope is what I'm getting at. I think that's also very Sandler-esque. And I think the Russell Brand version of it is the more Sandler style of the running gag that does nothing to move the plot, really is only here for the laugh, right?
That's a good point. I guess I can get that. I don't know. The weirdest thing about it is everybody acts like Bugsy's also a mutant, right? Clearly there was something in that wheat germ that Courtney Cox was feeding to these kids and that rodent. But then at the end of it, they have a double wedding with another guinea pig with giant eyes.
Yeah, so somebody else was feeding it. I mean, maybe that wheat germ was getting around.
Yeah, maybe it's like Logan, right? Which I think is now technically a Disney movie. Man, it's weird that Disney bought
it. It is on Disney Plus. It showed up the same day as Deadpool.
Crazy. But the question on the table is, as you presented and as we've been running away from, is magic real in the world of bedtime stories? Where did you come out on this? Because I know.
I have come down that magic has to be, right? I think that's pretty clear from what I've been saying, is that as much as the movie wants you to kind of get these reasons and these excuses why these things are happening in real life, at the end of the day, no. Like, at some point, you have to stop considering everything to be a coincidence, especially because it is a Disney movie, right? So it has to have magic, because that's what makes a Disney movie, right? Like, there's no reason for me as an audience member to not accept that there is magic in this film, period.
Fair. That's a solid argument that you present there. I guess the problem that I then have is, as we established in our commandments of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, magic is real in the ASCU. So is the magic that's in this movie there because of Disney, or there because of the Adam Sandler of it all? Is there a heaven and a hell in the world of bedtime stories? Are we perhaps in it?
I think the idea that like magic is introduced and we're not quite sure what's real and what's not definitely muddies the waters on the grander scheme of things, right? But I'm also a firm believer in that, like, you kind of have to take the majority of the whole, right? Like what's the old like bit about Lysistrata? Is everybody thinks about Lysistrata as this extremely feminist play, and it is for the majority of it, but everybody tends to forget that the last act of that play is that the women willingly give up their freedoms to go back under the thumb of men, right? Like so they kind of, it goes back to quote unquote normal at the end of that play, right? And it's the same thing here, is that like we could talk about how this is all kind of a story that his dad is possibly telling him, that the movie gives us all of these reasons why magic is not real, but at the end of the day you have to take what's in front of you as like the beef of reality, and the reality of this film is these little kids are making shit happen. Like clearly, right? And it's never even denied. It's not even something that Skeeter himself tries to run from. Instead, as we said before, problematically, he instead tries to harness that power instantly. He recognizes that it is a power. There's no disbelief in this in it.
That's you're not wrong. I can't disagree. That is one of those things. You've been dining out a lot on Lysistrata. Were you like recently in a production or
No, it's like a go-to story for
Yeah,
people.
that's
Like
true.
it's an old enough story, but that enough people have enough knowledge of that if I point it out, it lends some credence to what I'm saying.
Every single script analysis and writing course I took in college covered Lysistrata, to the
Yeah, I
fact
mean
that
it's
eventually
yeah.
I was just done talking about it.
Well, it's like when you mention Shakespeare, if you haven't read Romeo and Juliet, you're the odd one out, right? Like
Yeah.
it's one of those deals.
I get it. I feel it. And yet I still had to tutor an entire class on Hamlet, which feels like the natural progression from Romeo and Juliet. Sorry, that was a good time. And that's a story that I'll probably tell in the 300th episode. So be there, ladies and gentlemen. But yeah, so I get where you're coming from. I understand that because there's so much magic in this, magic has to be real. But then I guess we're left with the big question, Sijin. Is this in the ASCU in your approximation? Do you put this in the shared universe?
I don't know. I will say this: there inside me, there are two wolves. There is
Inside of
one that
all of us, there
really,
are two wolves.
they're really. But I mean, these two wolves particularly live inside me. I don't think anybody cares to feed these wolves. These wolves are long dead than anybody else. And it is that on the one hand, I very much want this movie to be in there. I mean, the idea of magic, the perfect realization that these villains in this movie are just the next natural evolution of Eric Gordon. Like, there's so much going on that really makes me say, like, it'd be really fun if it was. But there's also a big part of me that's also like, oh, but it's not, because it doesn't have a lot of the normal trappings, right? It doesn't hit our commandment list like we would expect one of these movies to. So like I'm pulled in two directions by what like by my biases, right? And so like with that in mind, I am really leaning on I don't think it fits in. I as much as it's kind of I'm being pulled in two directions, I feel like I'm landing more likely on that side.
Here is the only way that it could exist in the ASCU as we have charted it, as we have defined it, leading up to this 25th expedition into it. And that is if this is another children's story that sits on the shelf next to the puppy that lost its way. If this is a book that exists in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe that people can read to their children to teach them about, like, just because it's something that you expected doesn't necessarily mean that it's the path you're going to follow in life, or like there's no shortcuts to success, I can totally see it. But this story, by its very nature, by the fact that, like, family is such a conditional thing within so much of it, to the fact that like the fact that Mickey is weirdly rewarded with becoming the ninth richest man in the world because he marries Teresa. Like, why is he the ninth richest man in the world? Why doesn't Teresa Palmer, I'm sorry, Violet, why isn't she the one who's on that Forbes list? Right? Is it did he also go out and make a bunch of money, or is it just because she's his sugar mama that he's the ninth richest man in the world? Hyper problematic. I'm so sorry. I didn't expect this Disney film to be as problematic as it is, because I guess I just forgot that Disney is problematic.
I mean, Disney is the machine that people are talking about when they point to like, hey, this machine that's been creating culture for the last like 20 years, like it's really fed us a lot of toxic shit. Like, one of the biggest people running that machinery is Disney. Like, I don't know. I hate to surprise you with that knowledge.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's I just forgot about it. I forgot about it by the nature of approaching this as an Adam Sandler film and not approaching it as a Walt Disney film. I mean,
what is Lucy Lawless doing in this movie? Like, I mean, we talked a lot about the way that female characters are treated in this movie.
Blast.
I mean, like, clearly having fun is being a good second hand, right, to Guy Pearce, right? Like, Aspen to Kendall is very much, you mentioned Iago earlier, right, to his Jafar. Like, there's definitely a lot of that fun going on, and I can definitely see the joy in that.
Wait, I got a timeout. I got a timeout Zach Morris style here. Seijin, did you think Jafar was fucking Iago?
Well, no. I just meant in terms of secondhand men. Oh, what's a better example? Does Scar have Scar's hyenas, right? Like she's. I don't. And I don't think Scar was fucking hyenas.
It's just gonna keep going because Aspen and Kendall are fucking.
There well, yes, no doubt but not because mind. Either of them, but not because either of them think it's a relationship, right? They're fucking because they think that that's just what humans must be doing right
now,
right? I
think Kendall and Aspen's love is the purest love that I have ever seen in a Disney film. They clearly care about each other and are willing to put their love for one another, their support for one another, paramount in the progress of each other.
Aspen outright says, as long as there's a you to be there for, I guess I assume that that meant in terms of his, like, his career and, like, his personality, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, his level of respect, as long as, like, as long as you're worth it, I will definitely put up with you, but the second you're not, I'm tossing you to the curb.
I mean, you say
but I guess
that.
I guess she could have meant it a different way, is what I'm saying.
There is no reason for them to be working at friggin' Skeeter's Motel. Like
that's a weird level of like class bullshit as well in this movie. Is like, why is that like a punishment that these two people are suddenly employed? And I have to assume under Marty, like, well, like taken care of despite everything, right? Under Skeeter.
The fact of the matter is, you're both adults, right?
Yeah,
get a job somewhere else. Like you got jobs on your own. What if you don't have to?
And they
work
were pretty
here.
Good jobs.
Yeah,
like the hotel might not exist anymore, but those were pretty good jobs. Dude, somebody out there is not going to care too much about your scruples, considering the work they know you can do.
The hotel does exist because we didn't talk about the fact that the the fact that the whole resolution of this film. Is Skeeter goes and sees Donna Hind, portrayed by Aisha Tyler, and she is on the like zoning board, and she's like, "Ah, oh, no, you can't blow up a school to blow up to build a hotel. I don't know who told you that would be all right, but you can build on the waterfront, which is where you wanted to build initially. A mega Nottingham is still built." Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The company still exists because despite Barry Nottingham going into the field of medicine, which, hi kids, Devin Decker here, you can't just transition to working in the field of medicine.
Well, we are then told that who he is he's the head nurse at the elementary school. So, as we have currently seen in the atmosphere, there are a lot of positions in schools that apparently local governments are happy to hand to any dumb fuck. So,
maybe that's a paddling, Seijin, because you're damn right. No, it's just very, like, it's very much like he transitions to the field of medicine. I'm like, does he study? Or does he just, like, I'm a nurse now. I'm rich enough to declare that I'm a nurse. But the Nottingham Hotel Group continues with Violet in charge, and we've seen that she has a mind for business, so it's successful. And again, I don't think there's any reason why Kendall and Aspen couldn't maintain their employment there. Like, they by choice go work at Marty's hotel. Like, and then to be treated like shit in a weird way by this guy who was always nice to them when they had the power. Let me tell you, that's the thing that I just freaking hate that has never jived with me on like a personal level. And I'll try to maintain it. I'm sorry here. But like the idea that like the person who is subjugated as soon as they get power, their immediate reaction is to subjugate their former tormentors. Has never jived with me in any
bit of
media.
I got news for you, but it doesn't really jive with many people nowadays. Like, it doesn't work. It doesn't land. It's a gross moment in this movie.
And it's just like, maybe they just want to be happy and working with this guy. And it's just like, but they're together. And I hope at this point, the fact that because they're no longer pursuing some greater purpose in life, that they can just be happy together and embrace the love that they clearly yeah. have for one another.
I mean, they easily could have written in that they go and work under Skeeter at the Marty, right? And as running the place, because at the end of the day, Skeeter just wants the money. He doesn't really care about running a hotel. He's just happy to be a, like, there's so many nicer endings they could have definitely given that particular part of the story.
Yeah,
for sure.
Like, he could, yeah. like, freaking Kendall could be the manager, Aspen could be the desk clerk, and Skeeter the job of general manager slash owner that he wanted all along. Right. Right, he's still employing them. He's paying them. Right, they're not.
I mean, think about the way that the Nottingham is being run. Those two have high positions where they basically run the place. But then there's also Barry Nottingham above them. Right.
Right. It's just,
the movie presupposes that its own like structure from earlier could not apply. Oh yeah, man, it's
amazing. I don't love it, but I do. I mean, like, those two characters have this deep love for them. And you ask, what is Lucy Lawless doing? Having a blast, right? The costumes that she gets to wear as, like, yeah. the lobster lady and the troll. Like, there's definitely some practical there. I know that, like, a lot of this movie is CGI, but yeah. is a Buzz Lightyear suit from Disneyland that shows up when they could have easily just put fucking Buzz Lightyear in this movie?
Right,
we already had the CGI budget. It's lifting and dropping an asset, right? And take it from the freaking animated series. I don't know why I got to this level with it. So final rating here, I think we're on the no side, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
the hoops I just, have to jump through.
There's a lot of elements from Sandler movies by the very nature that was what they were trying to do, right? This was Disney building an Adam Sandler movie with Adam Sandler included. Like, and this is what they do, is they see a formula out there that's making buckets of cash. They want some of that cash, so they do it themselves, right? We talked about how this came out in the same year where you saw Iron Man, and not a decade later, they'd be doing the same thing with that, right? Like, they see a thing that's making money, they want a piece of it. And they tried to get their piece of it, and it made them just enough money that nobody got hurt, but not so much money that they thought, we can keep going. It's financially viable to keep going down this path. I mean, like I said before, we don't know of any major dust-ups behind the scenes on this, but maybe, just maybe, with like Tim Herlihy being present as a writer and stuff, and there being a lot of Sandler bits just kind of shoved in there that feel like at the last minute, maybe Disney was like, homie, don't want to play that, right? And they just walked away from any future deals with him because they were like, you're not making enough money to justify that behavior, and so we're not going to do this anymore, right? Like, that could easily be what goes on here, but somebody pulled the plug on them ever doing this again.
More than likely, where I would stand on that is it's Adam Sandler who, after this film, looks at what people are saying about him and does that deeply introspective self like reflection in a film like Funny People.
Yeah.
Where he pretends to be, you know, Dolphin Boy. And
so it
and
feels
all
like out of
like
right. So it feels like this movie is trying so hard to fit into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe that by that very point, it really feels like it doesn't work, because anything that is there feels like manufactured and not there because it is like a natural part of the world. It's like somebody created a facsimile. Oh my God, can't say the word. Facsimile of our world, right? And then like and then tried to pass it off as just part of this world. We'd all know that there was something off, right? Like some uncanny valley shit was going on. And that's what this feels like throughout this entire movie. I feel like I'm watching an Adam Sandler movie, but something's just a little off every step of the way, so it doesn't quite fit in for me.
At least the 30 people in the metaverse probably enjoyed it. That and the fact that, you know what this is? This is Never Say Never Again. This is the Never Say Never Again of Adam Sandler films.
Nice.
It's clearly an Adam Sandler film, but it is non-canonical. It does not fit in by its very nature of being so self-referential and so self-reflective of everything that has come before. You can put as much Blake Clark buying a hot dog in this movie as you want. That's not going to give it entry into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yeah.
And those are just the facts. All right, so that is the Adam Sandler cinematic universe episode for Bedtime Stories. Thank you very much to those people who reached out to us and requested that we look into it. And sincerely, even though it might have sounded like we were negative, that we were kind of down on it, a lot of that is some of the feelings, at least on my part, that I have towards Disney right now in the wake of Hocus Pocus 2. And that is something we will certainly discuss later on the Stay Report. So come there for that's a show about everything, not just about one topic like Adam Sandler. So if you want to hear about that, come by. And again, thank you to the fans for suggesting bedtime stories. And also, because of fan suggestions, it's time to announce the film that we're going to be watching in November. So, Sijin was given two choices, two wolves inside of him to feed last month. And you dropped
some knowledge a little bit earlier, I think.
possibly. So, for his birthday munch, Sijin decided, let's look at bedtime stories, which honestly, it worked out, right? Released on Jesus' birthday, according to people of the Catholic faith. Starts with a birthday, ends with a birthday. It's a wonderful birthday movie. Happy birthday, Sijin. Say it into your iPhone, your iTunes, Spotify, wherever you're listening right now. Happy birthday, Sijin. Sijin, you gotta let me know if you feel it, like a shudder in the force. 1,000 people yelling out happy birthday to you.
No, unfortunately, I lost those kind of connections when the Nano went the wayside. So if you're listening on a Nano, then I'm feeling that, but that's about it.
But Bedtime Stories is what he chose for that. So our next film that is going to be for the fans for November is going to be The Cobbler, which is a film... Admittedly, I have
I thought that was going to be the end of the statement, which is a film.
No, there are like people. It's not just fans who have been like on me to cover this one. This is one of those situations where driving home late, dropping our parents off at an appointment, just Dale and I in the car, and she looked at me with like the eyes of Jaws, those dead doll eyes of like. So Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. You guys are going to have to do The Cobbler, right?
And it's the last film he made before the big Netflix move. So yeah. we'll definitely talk about how it fits into kind of that move in his career. Something to keep in mind as you watch it.
Yeah. So that is so The Cobbler. If you want to be prepared for the next episode, it's The Cobbler, guys, and I'm looking forward to it on a very strange level, is what I can say. Because, again, it's one that I haven't seen yet, and one that people talk about and that people have said to me, when are you guys going to do The Cobbler? A lot. And I'm hoping it's more of a reign over me and less of a bedtime stories based on everything that's come before. Again, if you have enjoyed hearing us talk on one singular topic, Adam Sandler and his shared cinematic universe of films, you would probably also enjoy us talking literally on every topic with our other show, The Say Report. So that's also wherever podcasts are found. You can find us on The Say Report. And that one releases weekly. So if the monthly release schedule of the ASCU has got you down, find us at The Say Report.
I know this is going to date us, but we have a big ep coming up, a big number ep coming up. So check it out, please. Like we've been doing this for a while now, and we have a big celebration planned for you.
Yeah. So if you choose like after this episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe to jump over to the Say Report and just listen to our newest episode, I don't think you'll be disappointed. Hopefully. I don't know. Maybe I just called our shot and I'm not Babe Ruth. And we'll find out. But if you would like to talk to Sijin about his feelings about magic as it relates to Bedtime Stories, Disney, and the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, he is available on Twitter at Siege versus the World. And I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. Wish him a happy birthday.
Yeah, and if you have any of that that Kendall and Aspen fanfic fired up and ready, shoot it on over to Devin at Devin D. Decker.
Oh my god, dude, I'm so my heart is palpitating at the thought of it. Oh, I have to go. Just remember, ladies and gentlemen, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good night. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to AdamSandlerCinematicUniverse@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.